Charles Lord was a rocket scientist. He worked as a contractor for the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. For his daughter, M.G. Lord, he often shone as brightly and as distantly as the planet he wanted to explore, Mars. Charles Lord helped design the Mariner Mars 69 mission. He and his daughter, M.G., were estranged for years before becoming close at the end of his life. M.G. Lord set out to write about him some years ago, but since her own background is in cultural criticism, her previous book, Forever Barbie, analyzed the female archetype, she wound up writing about the archetypal male culture her father found himself in. And that culture was the culture of the Cold War and the American space program, with its secrets, its oddballs, its ambitious aims, and compromised means of getting what it wanted. M.G. Lord's new book is called AstroTurf, The Private Life of Rocket Science, and we welcome her to the show. Hello, M.G.
Hi, Jackie. It's great to be here.
Your dad was a lot older than you, M.G., right?
My father was 50 when I was born.
You describe your dad in this chapter, A Foot Soldier Story, and it really tells us what was in his heart. Would you read there for us, please, on page 21?
Charles Carroll Lord was a foot soldier, not a general, in the battle for what Cold War strategists called the high frontier. He was 59 years old when he began work on Mariner Mars 69, an older man in a young man's field. His earlier experiences, however, provide a context for the mission. He had witnessed the way technology was viewed at the dawn of the 20th century and how it came to be viewed near its end. He also fought in the War of Public Relations, one of 400,000 dads responsible for small components of the space program. He ensured that his near and dear had a stake in that program. Or as Donald Riley put it in a Cold War-era New Yorker cartoon, "Never forget, son, that your father sold office supplies to the company that made the box that carried the rocks back from the moon."
I love that. And it kind of goes to the heart of him because he really had a pretty adjunct role as a contractor working on the body of the probe.
But one of the things that I learned in this book that made me respect my father much more is the extent to which the small parts matter. More than once, a scientist who was really an important scientist told me, if a small part fails, the entire mission fails. And look at the Galileo mission to Jupiter. It successfully orbited Jupiter from 1996 until 2003, but it did so with the handicap. Its high-gain antenna never unfolded because a tiny speck of lubricant on a joint didn't work. This antenna that was like a furled-up umbrella never unfurled, and data that should have just poured back through a floodgate instead dripped through a straw.
What exactly is the Jet Propulsion Laboratory?
JPL is a regional NASA center that's had a hand in the design or flight of nearly every major U.S. planetary mission since 1958 when NASA was formed.
It is the most amazing world. It's kind of like going backstage, the people that Tom Wolfe never got to in The Right Stuff. It begins with four guys, a rocket, and a desert night.
Not just any night, but Halloween night, 1936. And at a place called the Devil's Gate Dam in the Arroyo Seco in Pasadena, this was the place and time that this group of Caltech graduate students and a few interlopers without portfolio set off their first little fireworks.
Let's talk about two of them who became the most well-known. Frank Molina is the co-founder of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Molina becomes extremely important to the program. Tell us a little bit about him.
Well, in my view, and in the view of many people in the aerospace field, Molina should be heralded along with Robert Goddard as the father of American rocketry. But because of his leftist politics, specifically, like many intellectuals during the Great Depression, he flirted for about 45 minutes with communism, and this really came back to haunt him during the McCarthy period. So his accomplishments are not as well known as they should be.
One of them, John Parsons, he was in a satanic sex cult?
Yeah, you could absolutely call it that. He was a priest in the Ordo Templi Orientis, what amounts to kind of a tantric sex cult. And he was a real irritant to his neighbors on so-called Millionaires Row, Orange Grove Avenue in Pasadena.
When you were looking at these early progenitors of this space program. I mean, what struck you about them? Were they people of vision? They were mostly male. You certainly found that to be the case.
Well, they were very dissimilar to my father, who had no involvement in any satanic cults, to my knowledge, and whose bookshelf, when I was growing up, had the main books I remember there, besides engineering books, were J. Edgar Hoover's Masters of Deceit, John Stormer's None Dare Call It Treason, and a little gem by Phyllis Schlafly called A Choice, Not an Echo. My father was nowhere near the left on that spectrum.
Right, right. Did he think that by exploring outer space, I mean, he was helping make America safe, he was a Cold War warrior?
It was almost a collective mindset, I think, at the time, that they were fighting the Cold War with their brains instead of using other weapons.
How did the culture of women change space engineering? There's a wonderful old picture in your book from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. I'm not certain of the year. It shows eight pretty young women.
Oh, the misguided missile pageant.
Misguided missile pageant. And they're beside a missile.
Well, you know, there were women at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in the 1950s and 60s. There were a lot of them, and they were computresses. They operated these rooms full of Friedan calculators, these, you know, big, heavy machines that went ka-thunk, ka-thunk, ka-thunk like a marching army. And you needed all of them to compute something as complicated as a trajectory. And the highlight of the JPL social season was when the computresses and a few other secretaries competed for the title of misguided missile.
But women really had an odd place there. You cite some literature, I don't know, is it official literature, that talks about not using women to help build rockets or anything connected to the exploration of space, because at certain times of the month, the extra acidity in their delicate skin would damage the equipment?
That was certainly a bizarre revelation from a nonfiction book by Alfred Bester at the height of the Cold War. And no one questioned this really strange male folklore.
You ran across an old movie that talk to kids about the space program that's pretty telling in terms of what it said literally about what boys should do and what girls should do.
It was extraordinary as a piece of classroom material.
It's called
Why Study Science, and it was made in 1955. And it shows your archetypal 50s nuclear family on a camping trip. And the boy looks up at the stars and says, I'm going to study science so that I can go to the moon. Then he adds that his sister doesn't have to study science because her mission is, quote, to hook some guy. Then it continued. There was her response, which was, what's wrong with that?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
To which her mother replies, nothing. You'll never need science to keep house.
Yeah.
And then the father says, well, what if Mr. Wright doesn't come along right away? You know, science can prepare you for a rewarding career as a dental technician or a nurse. Now, this in classroom material, it absolutely floored me.
Tell us a little bit more about your father. You write about him as a foot soldier, not a general, and the space program took him away from you.
What I mostly remember about my father was my father not being there. In the late 1960s, when I was just becoming a pre-teenager, my mother was dying of cancer. We were a family of three, and my father fled into the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. I have to say, though, at the same time that I resented what took him away, I was absolutely fascinated by what he did. The probes he worked on were scouts sending home exciting glimpses of new worlds. They were about hope, expansion, the future, things that at my mother's deathbed would not otherwise have crossed my mind. And the few moments of real intimacy that I shared with him were when he explained those missions to me.
What would he have made of where space exploration is today? Last year, of course, the Martian rovers Spirit and Opportunity went to Mars. I think it was Opportunity worked a lot better than Spirit, which got stalled. But Mars was explored, and he had worked on an early Mars mission.
I think my father would have been thrilled that scientists and engineers today have built on the knowledge that scientists and engineers gathered in the 1960s, even as I myself was thrilled.
You were at JPL when the very first image came back from the Martian rover Opportunity, and you write very movingly about it. You're standing there with the scientist of the mission, Steve Squires. Would you read that part for us, please?
Soon after the landing, the VIPs poured out of JPL. The lab felt like a lab again. I had pierced the world from which I had been excluded as a child. My hard-won breast badge announced that I belonged. And I understood the powerful grip that this world had upon my father, because it had an equally powerful grip on me. And it was particularly extraordinary when the first image came in, and the scientist and the journalist around me gasped, because it was like nothing we had ever seen. Yet if on the night opportunity landed, Steve Squires had a sense of what was ahead, he did not reveal it. He was the consummate cautious scientist. I will attempt no science analysis because it looks like nothing I've ever seen before in my life, he said. But he could not squelch his excitement. That outcrop in the distance is just out of this world, he blurted. Then he gave voice to what I suspect every scientist, technician, kid, backyard astronomer, or curious insomniac tuned to NASA TV was thinking. A thought that I'm sure had burned in my father's head as an engineer and has at some point galvanized every human explorer. I can't wait to get there, he said.
M.G. Lord is the author of AstroTurf, The Private Life of Rocket Science.